Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 at our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here's the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans. Welcome to the Peristyle Podcast on a Tuesday, talking some USC Trojan football with Dan Weber, beat writer and columnist at USCFootball.com. We have a lot of questions, but if you would like to send in some more, we love it too. Podcast at USCFootball.com, or you can call us or text us. The number is 424-254-9141. That's 424-254-9141. If you want to send a little text from your phone, hey, Dan, hey, Ryan, hey, Coach Hyde, hey, Gerard, we got a question for you. Just text it to us. Let us know. Next time we come on the podcast, we'll make sure to read it and do our best to answer it. You can also subscribe all the different platforms. If you're on iTunes, iTunes.com/Peristyle Podcast. That's the easiest way to get to us. We have our own URL on iTunes, but we're on Audio Boom and Stitcher Radio and TuneIn Radio and all of those. So go check it out. Google Play. So any way you want to download the podcast, you should be able to find it. Peristyle Podcast. Search for that. It's a pretty unique name, and you should be able to find it. All right. Well, we're going to talk to Dan Weber. We were out the USC had a summer workout this morning, and I got to witness Sam Darnold carrying the water to the rest of his teammates. I don't know what that kid can't do. But what's up, Dan? How you doing?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of, you know, his ability to lead this team, because he doesn't put on any kind of airs. It's just about, you know, what do we got to do? Let's get it done. Come on. And not that kind of ego at all, you know, where, you know, look at who I am or look whatever. It's all about, you know, getting the job done. And the kids notice. It's obvious they pay attention to that. But, he is pretty amazing the way he's come back. And he's had, you know, a big summer, and still you wouldn't know it. You wouldn't have any idea, you know, that he's anybody else, you know, other than, you know, the Sam. Although he's been so good since he's got here. I mean, since the first day he walked in summer, he's just been a special, you know, special talent. And he does stuff every day that you think you're probably glad that he's on USC's side if you're a USC fan. Threw a beautiful 40-yard bomb to Josh Emaiter-Baby today that had a whole lot of trajectory and arc on it, that, you know, where he's trying to put air under the ball and let your wide receiver run under it. And that's something that is real obvious that he's doing this summer. It's one of the things he said he really wanted to work on. And when you see him, he's changed that angle of release on the deep ball. And if he starts, and he's throwing them right on the money. So if he's able to do that, he's going to be pretty dangerous.
Yeah, certainly he is. And I'd rather, you know, it was cool to see him. I tweeted out a picture of him, you know, wheeling over the water jug to the teammates. But I'd rather see someone else do that. I don't need to see Sam Darnold doing that. I mean, it's nice. It's cool. He's a team player. But someone else step in. You know, you're a walk-on wide receiver. You go, hey, Sam, no, I'll get that. Something like that.
Although I think that the point there is he sees something that needs to be done, and he did, you know, let's get it done. And I think that gives him so much more ability in the huddle to be that guy who sees that thing that needs to be done and either does it or tells somebody to do it, one or the other. But he had a few plays off and said, what the heck, I can go ahead and do this.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it was strange.
It was a great photo. There's nobody else around. He just went and grabbed it and rolled it back, you know, out there where they could get to it.
Yeah. Okay, so before we jump into the show, I wanted to thank our sponsor, Trader Joe's. So definitely, if you have not checked out Trader Joe's, you certainly should. They're all over the country. In August, it'll be 50 years in business. So next month, they are 1 month shy of 50 years in business, and that's also when University Village opens up. What they call it, the USC Village, Dan? Is that what they're calling it?
I think University Village.
University Village, okay.
University Village, yep.
Yeah, and there'll be a Trader Joe's in there, so they're going to have a big grand opening for that. We'll try to be there for that and check it out. But it's that time of the season. It's warm outside. It's kind of wine and cheese. So if you want to go, you're going to one of those concerts in the park, or we have them in Hermosa Beach on the beach, I definitely recommend go pick up a bottle of wine. They got a lot of excellent values. Different wines from all over the world, and a ton of great cheeses that are at great prices every day. So, you know, from cheddar to Gouda to triple creme brie, fresh mozzarella, they got everything over at Trader Joe's. We love going there for little picnics and stuff, and you know, buying stuff for snacks, and of course for dinners. We always heat something up or cook something from Trader Joe's. So it's pretty fun. It always tastes good, and it's always reasonable. Everyone we talk to, because there's a brand new one next to our house in Hermosa, and all our neighbors go there, so it's a lot of fun. I know you're a fan too, Dan, of Trader Joe's.
No question about it. Yeah, you said it right. Wine and cheese. This is the perfect time of year for what they do so well is you go in there and you just start reading labels and it's fun. I mean, it's you don't even have to buy anything. Just go in there and browse and get some ideas.
Yeah. Very cool. So definitely check out Trader Joe's. We'll have more information about that grand opening at University Village as that gets closer, because we're getting real close to that. We're almost, we're halfway through July. So sometime during fall camp, that's all going to go down. So a lot of construction projects, Dan, and should be ending around USC really soon. Maybe that building, that neuroscience building next to the practice field that we have to keep kind of walking through the construction zone. Maybe that'll be done by then.
Yeah, that's my hope. I'm counting the bricks, and they're putting those bricks in place and the sidewalks, and they have you go in one direction one day and another direction another day. And it does look, there are a lot of guys there working today. So it does look like they may be under, some deadline to get this. I'm not sure the deadline is the start of football practice, but I'm guessing it's the start of fall, the fall semester. But we could say, we could tell them we'd like to have this done by the start of football practice. If you guys could do this, it helps get us to practice quicker.
All right. Well, we're going to jump into a couple of questions, and I got another little event that's coming up I want to tell everybody about. But let's get to some of these questions first. We have Stephen Poway. He says, I know it's midsummer when all of USC Trojan fans' hearts start to palpitate at the thought of fall camp being right around the corner. But dare I say, this summer is a little bit different. Who knew that USC was poised to become a basketball powerhouse with so many great returners coming back this year? And don't look now, there are now 2 4-star and 1 5-star commits for the 2018 class, with rumors of another 5-star player, considering USC, Duke, and Kansas possibly coming in early to play this year. So the two questions are, how did the USC basketball program going from being a lower mid-level recruiting program to elite almost overnight? And could this upcoming basketball season be even better than the football season? Move over, Clemson. Thanks, Stephen Poway.
Yeah, I mean, I had talked about this early in the summer, late spring, that USC already was the far and away the best preseason program in football basketball. I think USC, if you, give them, say, an average of third in the preseason, rankings, and you give the basketball team at that time, a 10, and that was, they're no question about it, and most people, the more they looked at it, said 10. And that was like, I think the next closest was Louisville with 7th in basketball and 17th in football. So USC was already the best combo program in the country. But if they get this Bagley kid, from Sierra Canyon, who is clearly the number one player in the country, and whether he's able to go early or not, you would think age-wise and, amount of time he's been in high school, he may have a chance to do that. But if he comes to USC, there are people that cover basketball, national basketball guys, who say that puts USC as the number one team in preseason. Now, I know Arizona's really, really got a lot of guys that can play, but there are people who say that would move USC. Right. And I'm thinking, do USC fans even have any idea what a world that would be like? Let's say the football, let's say you're in October, November, football team's playing for a spot in the Final Four, and here comes the basketball team opening up at number one with all their games on television and all this. It's like, USC's never been in that situation before. You know, I mean, very few people are. I mean, it's almost, you pick out, you know, all the other great programs in the country. I mean, I guess the closest we saw was Florida, maybe 10, 12 years ago, or 10 years ago, I guess, would be the last time you saw, you know, a program like that. But, it would be fun and it'd be interesting. And as some people were already speculating, if the Bagley kid comes to USC, USC might be the favorite to produce both the number one football draft pick, NFL pick, and the number one NBA pick. And that's like, are you kidding me? I mean, really, think about that. You think those people hated USC before? Oh, my goodness. And they open University Village, and it's like, if I'm USC, I tell all the celebrities, stay away. We don't need you. We got back without you. And it just makes people hate us even more, the more celebrities that start showing up when the program really gets going. But there will be people who would really, really be unhappy if USC puts together that kind of run and those two sports, because it's like there's got to be something wrong with that. It's just not fair. You know, if you're sitting in Starkville, Mississippi, and saying, how do we compete with that? That's not fair. but it, you know, and how did USC go from where they were to, how you stop shooting yourself in the foot every single day? I mean, let's face it, they hit a brand new arena a mile and a half down the road from two NBA franchises. How do you screw that up in a great school with a campus that just keeps getting better and better in the middle of one of the coolest places, you know, a kid could go to college? I mean, you had to try to screw it up the way USC was screwing it up. And they did try, you know, there's no question about it. I mean, once they had, you know, Tim Floyd was in here, they were pretty good pretty quickly. And, it's just, you can't be, you know, doing the things they were doing, but, you have to be, I mean, for example, Bagley's the number one kid in the country. Who's the number two? Ball, the modern day 7 foot, whatever, you know, Manute Ball's son. There are basketball players on top of basketball players out here. There are so many basketball players in Southern California. It's ridiculous. And for USC not to have been able to you know, benefit from that was just ridiculous. And now all you got to do is do things right. They've got two great recruiters. And I think Andy's been really involved in the Bagley situation. And there's a lot of excitement, as there should be. I mean, they, you know, whether they get him or not, they still have the, you know, personnel to make a run at, you know, at the Final Four. I don't think there's any question, but it's going to be fun, and it's going to be something people here are going to have to get used to, as to how do you handle October, November, and December maybe.
Yeah.
When you've got a couple of different focuses. It's and LA might be the best place in the world if you're going good. If you're really got it rolling, LA is the place to be, because LA loves the winter and they love the big time and they love the big, you know, spotlight. And if USC gets that, makes that happen, I know there will be people at USC who are standing, you know, would be in, you know, say a sold out Gallon Center saying, how's this happening? What's going on here? Why are we here?
Yeah.
But yeah, think about it. It could be pretty neat.
Let's jump to Jason down in Longhorn country. He said, thanks for the great work. I'd be interested to get Dan's thoughts on Rojo's progression this year at SC. Do you think he's primed for a big season? How has he been looking in practice? Have his hands improved to the point where he can be an every down back, or do you think he will have to sit in key passing situations this year? We don't hear much about him due to most of the conversation covering Sam and the defense. I'm interested to get your thoughts on his situation going to his third and potentially last campaign with USC. Fight on, Jason in Longhorn country.
Jason, I think, okay, the thing I really like about him is he's 205 now, kind of up from 195 last year, and I think he may look quicker. I think he's got that stop-start, you know, cut the other way, kind of move down perfectly. But at this weight, he's really got some force behind it. So I think he really adds to his ability to make quick cuts with power. I think DeLand McCullough has just really done a good job on the fundamentals with the running backs and breaking everything down. And I just think, you know, what they're doing is the kind of stuff that for Rojo, both the pass protection and, you know, the comfort level, the hands, with the, you know, swing passes and all the stuff they're going to do. I think the only thing that might not have him on the field all the time on third down is just the fact that they got a lot of backs that can catch the ball. And they got a lot of threats, and they got a lot of ways to get the ball to people in space, like to slot receivers crossing and reversing and stuff like that. They're going to do a lot of stuff, you know, to get the ball to people. But yeah, I don't think there's any reason this year that, you know, not to have Rojo on the field on third down. I just think they're going to give people, I think defensively, they're going to try to give them more things to defend than they really have enough people to defend. And I don't think Ronald will be a liability, you know, with his hands or his pass blocking. Because you don't want to get into that situation where if you take him out, everybody knows you're probably going to throw the ball. So I think that's a real point of emphasis for both Ronald, and he knows how important it is for his future. And for USC, because of, you know, they really want to be able to, you know, line up and make you guess what, you know, what's coming next. But I think we saw enough in the spring that his explosiveness is better than we had seen. I think that's, you know, I'm looking for good things. I just think I love that, you know, that the 205 pounds, that just looks exactly right for him. I thought 195 might be just a little bit for a guy that, you know, does run the ball well at the goal line, for example, and short yardage. I thought 195 probably wasn't quite big enough. I think 205 with an increase in, you know, speed and quickness, I think is really good for Rojo.
We got Hugo from West Covina. He says, my name is Hugo, longtime listener and fellow follower of the P. First, thanks for all the time and hard work you and your staff put in to keep us up to date on USC football news and recruiting. My question is for Dan. I recently rewatched Coach Clay Helton's presser after signing day. One thing he mentioned throughout the presser was consistency. What is your opinion on Coach Helton and the athletic department investing in keeping coaches at USC and keeping the coaching consistency in place if the team and staff have both a successful season and recruiting class? Thanks from Hugo.
Well, it was good this year. I mean, I think, and the best part of it was they kept everybody but Tommy Robinson, and one of those kind of deals that he could hardly turn down, and it wasn't necessarily one that when USC can match from LSU and Ed Orgeron. But for them to go out and get a DeLand McCullough who just, you know, checks every box. He's done everything. Has a great personal story. Teacher, educator, coach, player, NFL, college, had been a, you know, big time program, a, you know, Big Ten guy. before he came here, done some great recruiting. So, you know, if you're going to change the program, that's the way to do it. Exactly. Now, if they have the kind of year that, you know, if you're a USC fan, you're hoping they're going to have, and I know Clay has talked to me about this summer, that he just thinks every day they have T. Martin is a blessing and a bonus. But you look around the country, I was talking to some people in the SEC, and they were asking me, do you think he'd come here? And, you know, if we crash and burn this year, would he come here? So I think the fact that he was always acknowledged as one of the, you know, top handful of recruiters ever since he, you know, been at USC, and then to have the ability, you know, to be the offensive coordinator with a Sam Darnold and with the kind of spotlight that, you know, is going to be on USC and with the, you know, the demonstrated, you know, skill set that T has in terms of dealing with players, in terms of making recruiting decisions, in terms of, you know, actually recruiting. And then, you know, as the offensive coordinator, I think it might be hard. I mean, it might be hard to keep T if things, you know, go, you know, as they might. There might be, you know, one or two others that, you know, down the road, would certainly be, you know, interested in being a head coach. I think one of the blessings for the program right now is that I don't think that includes Clancy Pendergast. They just don't have any sense that's necessarily where he wants to go. I think, you know, where he is now is kind of, you know, what he wants to do. So, but yeah, you're right. I think the consistency of staff, I think you could see it at places like Florida State for Bobby Bowden when all of his guys started getting head coaching jobs. It was much harder, you know, for him to keep it going. Joe Paterno, kind of the same way you would see, or at Nebraska, at Alabama, you know, when they had trouble having, you know, consistency, for a number of years, it goes away fast. And, so, yeah, having the ability to keep these guys together, cause it's kind of a young staff, and, they figured out, you know, a lot of things on the fly last year, and, to be able to keep that all going, which they seem to have done a pretty good job of building on that in the off season, I think it's really important. So it won't be easy. I mean, I think there'll be some, you know, some job offers coming if they have the kind of year that you may not be able to fight all of them off. I just, you know, I think T will be the guy that they're going to come looking for.
Yeah, before we jump into more questions, I want to, there's an event coming up. It's here in Southern California. I will let people know about. So my friend Dan Michelle is, on the board, of a foundation called Your Grateful Nation. And it's, you can find it at yourgratefulnation.org. Or if you want to give him a call, it's 310-717-6466. That's 310-717-6466. And the event is coming up, it's in Manhattan Beach. At the Manhattan Beach Country Club on Thursday, July 27th. So that's actually the night of Pac-12 Media Days, a couple days before the start of fall camp at 6:30 p.m. So it's a dinner and speaking event, and the keynote speaker is Rob O'Neill, and he's the co-founder of Your Grateful Nation, which my buddy Dan is on the board. And it's an event where he's going to – so he's – if you don't know who he is, he's a former – Navy SEAL Team 6 member, and they're basically going to go that night, and he's going to tell you about how they got Bin Laden. The night that he was there, and the guy shot Bin Laden, basically. So they're going to go through what happened that night. So I guess he does a lot of speaking tours, but I guess this isn't something they haven't really gone into a lot of detail with. I think things got cleared, so it should be a really interesting event. I plan on going after Media Days, if you want to check it out. But all the proceeds will go towards helping special operation veterans transition from military careers to civilian careers. So it's Rob O'Neill, former Navy SEAL Team 6 member, and it's Your Grateful Nation. So they'll have all the information on their site, yourgratefulnation.org. So hope you can go check it out. Yeah, I've never heard him speak, Dan, but I've heard some really good things about him.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly seen him, you know, talk on, I guess he's on Fox an awful lot. I don't know if he's officially a contributor or not. I don't know that he's ever gone into just like total detail about, you know, I've heard some of it, but not have him, you know, heard him speak about exactly all the you know, the things that happened, which, be interesting to hear some of the stuff probably that he can't say on television.
Yeah, I would think.
And, I think that'd be really interesting.
Yeah, well, go check it out. And if you have any questions, you can email me, too. I can forward you all the information, too, just podcast at uscfootball.com. But yourgratefulnation.org, you can check it out. We got a quick one from Tarek, Dan. What can we expect from Rashim Green in year three?
Well, I think he's going to be quicker. He's going to be stronger. He's leaner. He's down to 275. He looks a lot like, a little taller maybe, his mentor, BKU, Kenichi Udeze, his D-line coach, I think got himself down to about 275 pounds when he was an All-American. I think he, you know, started at almost 400 pounds his senior year in high school when they told him, Ed Orgeron told him if you lose, I don't know if what was the deal, 50 pounds or whatever. You know, we'll consider you for a scholarship. And so I think Rashim, the big difference that I saw is it was hard to get him to tell you what he was thinking and what he was doing, his first couple of years. And now he sounds like, you know, he's a veteran. He's a leader. He wants to talk about, you know, helping the younger kids and, just stuff that he is kind of all grown up, as I said yesterday, and the story about Rashim, I just think he can be somebody that's going to be difficult for some of those big, you know, offensive linemen to block. And I think, you know, it's one of those, I don't think he was totally with the program his first year for sure. He had been so dominant in high school, and you just don't play against kids like you play against, you know, when you're playing Alabama or Stanford. And I think he was a little resistant to some of the things and the demands and the details of all the techniques and how they want you to use your hands and what have you. And so it didn't get off to as good a start as I think a lot of people maybe thought it might. And then he really, I think, started coming on last year and led the D-line in tackles. And I think he was, he led the Pac-12 in blocked kicks. I think he was number 5 in the nation with 2 blocks. And he's got that kind of ability to penetrate. And I think that's got to be the thing that this defense figures out how to do, because they only got 26 sacks last year. And they have to get to the quarterback. And the ideal thing is if you've got guys who can get there on their own, where they don't need help, they don't need, you know, blitzes, and they don't need double teams and all that to free somebody. And so I think that's what you're gonna see more of, you know, Rashim this year.
Let's go to Steve. He says, thanks for all the great work. Watching the PRP highlights on the uscfootball.com site, I can't help but be very impressed by Randall Grimes. I know it's very early, but he looks so smooth and almost cat-like out there with long arms and excellent speed and balance. Is it too early to give huge kudos to the USC recruiting team last year for offering and landing this 3-star recruit from Las Vegas? Thoughts? And are there any other freshmen out there who are already impressing? Thank you from Steve.
Yeah, absolutely about Randall. I mean, he's, again, you want to, you can watch, you know, the video and all that, but you need to see him in person, and he really jumps out at you. I mean, he's, you know, and I think more than anything, it's just kind of a collective thing. I mean, here he's 6'4", and you got two safeties, Bubba and Isaiah, who are 6'3 and 6'4". And I know Austin Jackson went by us a couple of times today, and they've got him listed at 6'6". He's all of that. He just has some really big body kids that, as a group, this freshman class, I'm really impressed with them. I mean, they look like, you know, the kind of athletes you have to have, to win at this level. And, it's hard to, you know, just say this kid or that kid, but, you know, Jody Lewis, I think, shows you he's a physical. Everybody's, you know, thinking, well, who's the next guy that's going to step up for Juju? You know, that physical, you know, 210, 215-pound receiver. I think Josh Amater-Baby obviously, you know, fits into that category and showed us some things today. Michael Pittman, of course. And Jody Lewis, I think, you know, is there. And then, you know, Grimes is kind of an interesting because of his length and his speed. That's the thing when you start looking at, you know, the receiving group, you just, you know, well, this guy, I like this guy or this guy, I like that guy, or this guy. There's a lot of guys to look at. Tyler Vaughns and Ryan wrote about him, and you watch him again today, and he's got more quicks than I think I realized, and more ability to find, you know, that open space, kind of a little bit taller, you know, version of Deontay Burnett, who just looks sensational this summer. He just looks like he's got whatever that it factor is as a receiver. Deontay just has it. And, but you start going down the list and there are a lot of guys, to like. Now, what happens when the pads go on and people start really impeding your progress and don't want to let you, you know, get to that spot or get down, you know, get past them or whatever. And you may, you know, you find out, who can do that. But, you know, it's easy to like these kids. This receiving group.
All right, Dan, let's see. Let's move on to Mark in Crown City. Frank Martin was active and vocal member of the 2016 recruiting class. However, he doesn't receive much mention in the current PRP updates. Where does he fit in with the current offensive line giants? Thanks for your tireless efforts and keep the Trojan Nation connected. Fight on, Mark in Crown City.
That's good. I have to confess, because we're limited to the far sideline and the every single day they start at the other end and the defense is on our side. So we get to see the defense. We're life or death to see what the offensive linemen are doing. I'll be honest. So we see them, you know, they come in as a group and they go out as a group. But, until they put the pads on, I just hate to, you know, try to, you know, handicap them or say what they're doing or whatever. You know, for them, it's mostly right now just, you know, getting to, you know, the plays and the steps down and all that kind of stuff. And you don't get to really get any kind of a sense other than, you know, how big they are, how, you know, easily they move or that kind of thing. But it's just, you know, you hate to not be able to do it, but there's just not that much you can tell anybody about. The D-line, you get a little bit more of a sense of because they get a chance to, you know, make a move here or make a move there or show off. But you don't get that sense with the offensive line because they really don't get a chance to block anybody. And, so, you know, it looks like they know what they're, I mean, I will say this, the offensive line looks pretty precise and it looks like guys know what they're doing, which is why they're doing it the way they're doing it. But, to try to pick out somebody and say, okay, you know, he's doing this. That's just not something we're going to be able to do. Yeah. It's just, and they got a lot of guys who are kind of, you know, close, the same sort of guy. And they haven't exactly found where they're all going to be. And I think they're still going to be mixing and matching for a while. So again, you don't want to get, you know, premature in terms of, you know, where they're going to end up or how they're going to fit into the rotation, but he, you know, certainly looks like he belongs with this group.
Let's see. Let's go to, yeah, it's really hard to see the offensive linemen. So, we apologize, but they're just, it's hard. Ian in San Francisco. Thanks for the podcast. Listen to every show. Well, thank you, Ian. I just listened to Dan talk about the sanctions and I have two questions. One, he said something along the lines of, if this were to happen again, USC would take what it learned from last time and fight back. Although I appreciate the optimism, what would indicate this? Honestly, it'd be the most USC thing in the world to do the exact same thing all over again. They've had no public comment about any of the previous failures, as far as I know, and I have no reason to see it playing out differently if it were to happen again. I hope I'm wrong. And then two, he said, Dan said something along the lines of, compared to other schools in the SEC and Big Ten, I witnessed USC was as clean as it could be. Without naming names, what did you see at those other schools? So two things there. Fight on, Ian in San Francisco.
Well, just little things like, oh, I don't know, the players' parking lot, you know, where they had, like at Ohio State, and this came out publicly, that, you know, they were doing an audit of the compliance department, and they wanted to see if, for example, things like, were they registering all the cars? And turned out there were 44 unregistered cars. Now, USC got just whacked because Reggie Bush's compliance form wasn't completely filled out for that 9-year-old Impala. So they go and some auditor stands by the guarded players parking lot at Ohio State and jots down all the license plate numbers. And they came back with 44 unregistered license plate numbers for the Ohio State parking lot for players. Just stuff like that. I mean, I remember at Kansas State, for example, I think where we parked was right next to where the players parked. And that was an eye-opener. I mean, there were some of the most extravagant pickup trucks you have ever seen in your life in that parking lot. I mean, for a while at Kentucky, they obviously had a basketball dorm that, you know, you could have put in Malibu and sold it for God knows how many million dollars. I mean, that, and then the NCAA said, well, you can't just build a dorm just for, you know, athletes, stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, honest to gosh, and this isn't, at Kentucky, there were times that they had like, after the game, and this is unbelievable, they still let us go into the locker room after the games in basketball. But the media were the second group in. The first group in were the boosters. So you go into the locker room after a basketball game, and guys were still counting the money, players. Or they were laughing. And said, that guy only gave me $50, you know, or whatever. I mean, and that's a long time ago, and that's when things were kind of out of control and what have you. But there were things happening at a lot of places. I mean, just, for example, Notre Dame. You got the sense that the Notre Dame person on the USC Committee on Infractions case was the number two person at Notre Dame and the chief legal person and what have you. And she was the one that was grilling Todd McNair and Pete over Reggie Bush's 9-year-old Impala, having not realized that it didn't get fancied up and tricked up and all that till after Reggie left school and after he signed his NFL contract, or that it was all done by a magazine who wanted it on the cover. So she was on USC about how you couldn't have known and blah, blah, blah. And then soon thereafter, Michael Floyd runs off the road at Notre Dame in, I think it was July, might have been August, before his senior year, in a brand new Cadillac. And to my knowledge, no one at Notre Dame seemed curious in the least about where he got this brand new Cadillac that he ran off the road. It's just stuff like that. It's just, you know, that inconsistency and the way they went after USC and the way they look the other way, you know, for everybody else. It was just, it was ridiculous. And the fact that, you know, you had people on that committee like Paul D, who wanted USC to get worse penalties than Miami got when he was the athletic director overseeing all that, you know, was going on at Miami. And you think, how does this guy get the right to be the chairman of the Committee on Infractions after what he was the athletic director at Miami for? And just those kinds of things. I mean, the Cam Newton case at Auburn, where everybody knows what the bidding was and where the money went and how it went. And they went into all sorts of contortions and finally came up with the, well, he didn't know about it. Yeah, maybe everybody else did. You know, the schools, the coaches, the bidders, the people who came up with the money, relatives, but we don't think Cam really knew about it, so it was okay. You know, it just one after another of those that you, the more you know about it, the one you just want to bang your head against the wall and say, what, how is this happening? But
What about the USC?
There is a famous story about a guy who still makes commercials and was a great NBA player, and a school drives up to his house and says in a brand new car, and the coach gets out, head coach gets out, and he comes out and his mom and everybody, and wow, thanks, coach, and he says, oh, that's not the half of it. And he opens the trunk and it wasn't the car that was the big deal. It was the money that was in the trunk. And it's like, you hear these stories and you'd say, oh my God. And you believed almost all of them, to be honest. I mean, you wish Charles Barkley someday would be able to just go ahead and tell his stories about all, and he's told some of them, but, the stories are just, you know, they're out there, and USC was in a far different place from any of this stuff that I had been kind of familiar with over the years.
Now, what about USC fighting, like if they would do it different the next time?
Oh,
that's
I
a
think,
good point, Ian.
I don't think they could not fight it this time. I think they listened to all the wrong advice and didn't, for reasons that, you know, maybe will never come out, personal reasons that and personal, you know, advancement themselves, where they put themselves ahead of the school. And I don't think that would happen again. I don't think people would let it happen again, because, you know, people said, well, you can't sue the NCAA, you can't. Turned out you can, and there were people who knew that you could. It's harder for a school than it was for Todd McNair. But I just think the whole way they did it, you never tell them you're not going to go after them. You never say, no matter what, we're not suing you. Never say that, you know, and make them wonder. I mean, Penn State sued them. Now, Penn State, you know, got legislators in the state of Pennsylvania to go after them, but they pretty much, you know, threw in their cards. I mean, Ohio State announced at the press conference when, you know, the NCAA announced the issues involved with Ohio State, which were so few. I mean, of all the things they could have gotten Ohio State on, what they went after was just a small, small part of it. But Ohio State at the press conference said, don't come at us with that USC stuff. We're not doing that. And, you know, everybody who basically said, don't come at us with any of that stuff, you know, benefited from it. And I think even USC would be able to be smart enough next time to say what they did this time really doesn't work. And, you know, I would think they would get better advice this time, because there is better advice out there, and they just chose not to listen to it last time. This time, they were, for example, they got the gift that no team, no program has ever gotten when Judge Saller ruled that there was malice and hatred for Todd McNair and that they used the Todd McNair thing to get at USC, USC was given a gift. Nobody who ever got involved with the NCAA ever got a ruling like that, you know, from a court. And it opened up. USC could have gone at that point in time, could have made a run at the NCAA and reopened the case and said, look, you know, statute of limitations starts now because we didn't know any of this. And USC basically at that time could have demanded all the emails and could have demanded all the, you know, records of the Committee on Infractions that USC ruled on the USC case, and they didn't. And that's where I think they could have threatened to go to court, or threatened to go to court of public opinion, or threatened to go to the NCAA convention and put it on the floor and say, we want access. This is, you know, this involved us, and this really did us terrible damage, both public relations and financially, and deprived 30 potential scholarship kids. And yes, he chose not to do any of those, and that was really unwise. And I don't think they could get away with not doing it the next time. I don't think whoever would be in charge at USC could turn his back on what's happened since. It might be hard for the guys that were involved in it, and now if they change their mind, they would have to admit how badly they were advised and how badly they decided. But if it comes up again, I don't think that excuse wouldn't work. They'd have to get it right the next time, and they've seen enough people who've gotten it right. I would think USC would not get it wrong the next time. There better not be a next time, though.
Right.
Yeah. I would think USC, I mean, the one thing, USC was treated so badly and so unfairly. I think it's like getting an inoculation for smallpox or whatever. You won't get smallpox, you know, again. I mean, I think they're inoculated, I would think, you know, from the NCAA at this point. I would think the NCAA would not want to come near USC, especially considering that, you know, the Todd McNair case is set for April trial in L.A. I would think USC is pretty – USC is almost as safe as the SEC schools are now that the chairman of the Committee on Infractions is the commissioner of the SEC, Greg Sankey.
Yeah, that's convenient. We got Paul in Santa Clarita. He says, hello, Dan. This email is long, so bear, please hang in there with me. I'm sorry, Paul. I'm not in the mood to read like five paragraphs of email, but I'll give you a summary of it. Looking at the Pac-12 conference quarterbacks, he said it's a scary group. So talking about like Sam Darnold, Jake Browning, Luke Falk, Josh Rosen, Justin Herbert, Stephen Montez, Keller Chris, like Troy Williams at Utah, a lot of really talented guys. He said no other conference has this kind of top to bottom talent. It's a gauntlet that you have to go through of Pac-12 quarterbacks. He wanted to get your thoughts on that. And secondly, do you think the Pac-12, with Larry Scott, like, say this is the conference of quarterbacks or some tagline like that? And then lastly, Vince Young showed USC in 2006 in the Rose Bowl a hot quarterback can single-handedly carry his team to a victory. Of the Pac-12 quarterbacks that USC will face this year, who do you feel has the most potential to pull a Vince Young and lead his team to an upset victory over USC? That's Paul in Santa Clarita.
Huh, that's a good question. No Vince Young types, that's for
no.
Sure. But
I'd go with Luke Falk at Washington State just because of the Friday
night
game. Yeah,
I mean, he's not that type at all, but you're right. Yeah. If there's anybody that, I mean, he's going to do it with his arm. And we saw him, Ryan and I were there that day that it rained, and it was, what, 33 degrees and raining the whole time. And poor kid, oh, good quarterback, broke his leg against USC. And here comes Luke Falk, the walk-on. And he was good. It
yeah.
was like, where did this kid, who is this kid? I mean, and it was like 49-0 or something when he got in the game or whatever it was. It was pretty bad. But he showed a lot of moxie that day. And ever since then, he's got a lot of what it takes. going to do it by throwing the ball. I don't know if there's anybody in this group, Troy Williams maybe, that's going to run the ball and beat you that way.
There's not really a lot.
A lot of guys that, you know, kind of ready for the NFL. I know the SEC is finally saying, oh, look at us, look at us. We really have quarterbacks this year. Really, no kidding. Come on, give us a shot. But that's the one thing that, you know, everybody looks at the Pac-12 and says, wow, if only we had quarterbacks like that in, you know, in our league. But, it's going to be fun to, you know, fun to watch these good Pac-12 quarterbacks. And this is why how important it is for USC to get pressure on the quarterback. They just have, in this league, you got to figure out ways to get to them. And it wasn't quite so obviously. USC had 26 sacks. Really isn't very good. But because they gave up only 12, and I guess only like six of those after Sam became the quarterback, you didn't notice it. Because they weren't, you know, essentially USC wasn't giving up any, won a game. But this year, I think, and by the time, you know, they got to the Washington game, Jake Browning played under a ton of pressure. And he didn't look like Jake Browning in that game. And I think that's the way USC has to, you know, treat these other quarterbacks. They cannot beat you if they're, you know, lying on the ground.
Yeah.
It can't be done. And so that would be my, my prescription would be not to let them, you know, be the quarterback they want to be. I mean, I thought they did this. This is a perfect example was the Las Vegas Bowl with Derek Carr, who, when you watch him throw the ball, you thought, man, this guy, he looked like a pro. He didn't look like a pro that day, though, because everything had to come out sooner than he wanted it to. USC was really into that game. It was one of those, Clay's first chance to coach, and they were trying to win it for Ed, and, you know, they just were so ready to play, and you realize they had better athletes than Fresno State did, and there was just no way that they could protect Derek Carr. And he had to throw everything early and quick. And now you see how good he is. He was that good then, but he isn't, you know, nobody's that good if you got people in your face and you're running for your life. And I think that's, you know, kind of the way this team has to go with against all these quarterbacks they're going to be playing against.
We got Paul in Vegas, Dan. And so actually a follow-up, he sent a question in yesterday for Coach Harvey Hyde about potentially dumping the UNLV game for 2000, I think it's 2018, and signing up for one of the preseason games like you did with Alabama. And referencing that, he was saying, would it be feasible or even easy to buy out one of those games if an offer came in to play a powerhouse team at a neutral site like we did with Alabama last year? What are the mechanics of swapping opponents like that going into a season? Thanks from Paul in Vegas.
Yeah, that's definitely been done, and that would be done, I think, at this point. And whether you do it by, you know, whether you just completely buy them out or you just move the game to another year or something like that. I mean, I think there's talk of creating another, week one game and putting it in Las Vegas. And putting it in the new stadium in Las Vegas. So maybe USC could work that out where USC would play someone like, you know, an Ohio State, a Michigan, an Alabama, or whoever in Las Vegas. But I think that ought to be on the agenda of that new stadium in Vegas, because it'd be nice not to have all of those games, you know, back east or in the south, you know, and I think this year they're in, you know, Dallas, Atlanta, and Houston, but it'd be nice to bring one of those out here.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of game, if you played, you know, whoever, if you're a Southern California college football fan, you get in your car and you drive to Vegas or you catch a flight, I think it would be a really, you know, a natural, and I guess that new stadium and NFL stadium is going to be, you know, a great stadium, but I'd like to, you know, see see something like along those lines. And maybe if USC gets involved, maybe they could be a player there in terms of, you know, arranging, you know, the kind of opponent, you know, like a Georgia. They, you know, haven't crossed the Mississippi in like 1,000 years. That'd be like a cool game, you know. School hasn't maybe started, and you know, you get, you know, the whole nation watching you, or Florida, somebody like that, or Oklahoma. I just think that would be that'd be a great game, and I think it helps prepare you for the playoffs as well. So I think I would be surprised if that doesn't happen in Vegas. I think that's going to happen.
All right. We got a few more, man. This, it's pretty good. Keith in Oakland. I've lived the past few years up in the Bay Area, and it's hard to see that he said he had a chance to see regularly the dominance of the Warriors, where they're able to sit their stars in the fourth quarter of games when they're blowing out their opponent, saving them for the postseason. With no bye week this year, how important will it be, for USC, to not only win games, but do so in a dominant fashion as to where they could rest key starters and reserves and not support that and not subject them to any additional chance of injury in the fourth quarters of games? Thanks and fight on, Keith from Oakland.
Yeah, Keith, I think that's a thought that they're really, I mean, it's something they're thinking about, that how are the different ways that they're going to be able to combat the, you know, 12 straight weeks. And if you had the 5 preseason weeks, you know, you're basically 17 straight weeks without a break. So how do you do that? I think one of the things, and I don't know exactly why it didn't always happen this way, but last year, I think the first half points total, USC was like 262 or something, and opponents were like 120 something. I mean, USC was really, a fast starter last year, and probably didn't quite have the depth that, you know, that you would just be able to put people away. And so weren't always able to get everybody in. I think they're going to start with a deeper rotation, and I think they're going to, you know, play more people, but I think, you know, they're going to give whoever the backup quarterback is a chance to actually be a quarterback and not just hand the ball off, where they, when you come into the game, you get to run, you know, much of the, you know, the game plan. But I think that's a really good point. The ability to rest your guys, in the fourth quarter, and to be able to, you know, get those other guys a lot of reps. I think that's going to be, I think, really important for this team this year. So, and I do know they're thinking about it and trying to figure out how exactly, you know, do they get that done. And I think it'll be crucial for, you know, to be fresh at the end of the season. And then they do get the benefit of that. You know, their bye comes in week 13. So when, you know, Oregon's playing Oregon State and Washington is playing Washington State and Stanford is playing Cal, or Stanford might be playing UCLA that week. I'm trying to think. One of those, Stanford has a game. Arizona State. But when you look at whoever they're going to, you know, if USC wins the South, whoever they're going to get coming out of the North will be coming off a rivalry, a big rivalry game. So it could work in the long run that you're better off having the bye then, but you got to get there. But they're absolutely thinking about it and absolutely trying to figure out what is the best way, you know, to handle that. But the Warriors thing is a good point.
Yeah. We have, let's see, I forget, so I didn't write down his name. He's from South Bend, Indiana. I apologize. I don't know if it didn't copy over. It looks like a bunch of dashes where his name were on the email. So there might be like emojis or something that didn't, I don't know. But he said, first off, I'm a huge fan of the podcast and appreciate the dedication you and your team have put together for the podcast. We've got a lot of people like thanking us for like our dedication.
Wow.
This week. So that's good.
Yeah. Hey, what,
it's our job.
You know,
this is kind of what we do. But, after witnessing the improbable victory the Trojans got against Penn State in the Rose Bowl. Sam Darnold has Trojan Nation wondering, how far can the team really go this year? I think the three qualities that separate Sam from other quarterbacks around the country is his pocket presence, athleticism, and humility he demonstrates. What are a few qualities you think separate him from other quarterbacks this year in college football? Thanks and fight on from South Bend, Indiana. I apologize, I don't have the name.
Well, I think his ability to see down the field while he's moving. And when you say pocket presence, I think he has an innate sense of where he is and where everybody else is. And it was, I mean, again, I've said this a number of times, but the one frustration you got from talking to the Penn State coaches after the Rose Bowl, they could not figure out how possibly Sam didn't go down and how they didn't get to him. They were athletic. They were tough. They were veterans. They did everything you could possibly do to try to get to him. And they said, we couldn't. There was just no way. The thing I think that makes Sam different is that first guy that you know, comes through. And yes, he unfortunately probably had more breakdowns or whiffs than you would like. But very often there was a guy coming through clean. And where many quarterbacks look at that guy and go, uh-oh, Sam looked at the guy and would say, cool, I'll beat this guy. And two things would happen. Well, three. First of all, he'd beat the guy. I mean, they just never took him down. He could go whatever direction you needed him to go. Front, back, side, whatever, take off, running. Whatever he had to do, he would do it. So now he's got that guy behind him. So now he's turned upfield. And his receivers have had additional time to go find open space. And now Sam has turned upfield, and he's got really good ability to figure out where that open guy is. And at this point, because he's eliminated the first guy, USC is now playing 11 on 10. And that's the kind of advantage you'll take every day. That, you know, I'd love to be 11 on 10. But it's going to be interesting to see how teams decide to play against Sam, because if you decide, you know what, there is no point in trying to get him or trying to blitz or whatever. We're just wasting a guy. They may go the other direction and try to drop as many people back and just try to, you know, have somebody everywhere and make him, you know, throw through, you know, tight windows, which he obviously showed on the game time touchdown, that, you know, can do that as well. But I think that's that whole package of Sam and his unflappability. I mean, for a redshirt sophomore, freshman, starting, what was it, his 10th game, to lead them on a couple of those late drives. I mean, he didn't show a hint of a nerve, a hint of a, oh gosh, this is a big deal, or how are we going to get this done, or whatever. It just couldn't have been more mad. I mean, he wasn't any different than he is on the practice field. It was just, you know, let's go do it, and, you know, no big deal. Let's, you know, we'll be fine. And I think, you know, for a quarterback, you got to have all those, you know, all those, the ability to do all of those things. And he pretty much got it. They love playing with him. They trust him. What he's done, and we talk a lot about, you know, the chemistry with the receiver and the quarterback, and where the receivers have to earn that trust and all of that. But the other way that goes is they trust Sam so much. I mean, you cannot overstate how much his teammates trust Sam. And I think that may be, you know, another place where he's a little different. The way he's been able to inspire that trust in his teammates is pretty special.
We got a couple more topics and then we'll let you go. Keith wants to, he had 2 points. One, he's mad that they're not selling number 14 jerseys in the bookstore. And two, He really hates the ball caps, the Nike ball caps. He wants them to go back to New Era. Any thoughts on those two topics?
See, I don't know what that contract deal is with Nike. I mean, they may not be able to. I don't know if they have a New Era contract. I would guess the more Nike gives them, the less wiggle room they're going to have, to sell anything but Nike. And I understand a lot of people like the New Era cap, but I think that's as they say, at a pay grade far above us.
Yes.
That's the lawyers deciding that one. If I were Nike and were giving USC as much money as they are, I wouldn't want them to be putting their logos on another cap and selling it in the bookstore. So I don't know how that all works. So where, clothing manufacturer who just manufactures one particular item, can they get any part of the business, when you've got somebody like a Nike that does the whole, does everything? I don't know what the legalities are there, but I'm guessing that's played into it. And tell me the other question, right? What was,
The 14 jersey, the Sam Darnold jersey.
Oh, and I don't know. Is it because he's not a senior?
I have no idea. I don't know why.
I think they sold Barkley's jerseys before he was a senior. I didn't know that. That's an interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we'll inquire about that.
Yeah. We'll see what we can find out.
That's interesting. Because, I think there's a really good chance he's going to be a captain. And I wonder, what the deal, in terms of, again, what the legalities are on who makes the choice on the jerseys and is there a limitation on the numbers and all of that kind of stuff. I'm not kind of a numbers guy. I don't pay as much attention to that as a lot of people, and I know it really does matter. I just let that stuff go, and but it clearly matters, and we'll try to pay some attention, and because when you've got Sam Darnold, I can see why people would kind of like
have
a Sam Darnold jersey. Although it's interesting, do they put the names on the back of the jerseys that they sell?
No, I don't believe so. I think it's all just numbers.
I'm trying to think if I ever remember, because they're not authentic, not necessarily the same exact jersey. And I think that is one of the, obviously USC is one of the, I guess, three schools maybe that have never put their names on the back of their game jerseys and that, which is really, really cool. And probably a cool thing for the fans to just have the jersey and not the name on the back of it. But I didn't know if they ever did that for USC on the fan jerseys, whether they ever put names on them or not. I wish I paid more attention, but I don't.
We'll see what we can find out for you there.
Number 14 will be pretty popular, I would think. That might be the kind where people go out and
they
have their
own
made up, where you buy a USC jersey without a number, and then you go to a sporting goods store and get them to put 14 on there.
Yeah. Okay, one last topic is about the Coliseum. So we avoided it last week. We're not avoiding it this week. There's a voicemail, and I'll play the voicemail, then I'm going to read the question for you as well. We have an email, too. So here's the voicemail first.
Hello, Ryan and Dan. This is in reference to the Coliseum makeover. If the administration still insists on the same renderings for the monstrosity box seat arrangement, instead, I would suggest just three long rows, which are non-projecting, on each side of the Coliseum with angled ends to avoid blocking the view of adjacent viewers. That would seem to be a much better way to go and blend right into the framework beautifully. Keep up the good work. Sincerely, AG.
So that's AG Dan. And then Troy 75, he wants to know, what do you think, did the Olympic bid play a role in this proposed configuration? He's saying it's hard for him to believe that the big SC donors would be willing to ruin the game experience for thousands of other fans merely so they could have luxury seats. I'm not buying that story. But so he, that's what his kind of point is. What do you think on both those topics?
I mean, I like the idea of the rim and all the way around. And it's worked at an awful lot of, you know, the SEC stadiums. And I think the University of Wisconsin did something similar. And, you know, I think, but they promised the donors that they would give them as close access to the field as possible, because they went and they followed the model of Texas A&M. And Texas A&M has a triple-deck stadium, and they attached the donors' founders' suites below the second deck and right above the first deck, which is only, you know, 30 rows, you know, in depth. So they were able to put these people really close to the field, and that's what they promised the founders. So the founders are getting those first two levels of the tower, if you want to call it that, where USC screwed up, and I think it's more incompetence than anything, where they screwed up was that's all they needed to do. I mean, you're talking about, you know, maybe $220 million of the $270 that they needed would be accomplished in the founders' suites. They didn't need to go and then, you know, take out the rest of those 9,000, you know, prime seats, and put in 1,100 club seats and all of that. That's just people honestly not knowing what they're doing. And USC probably didn't understand, and there's some arrogance and some ignorance and a combination of a lot of things that, you know, are going to make it no longer look like the Coliseum. And are going to displace 9,000 of the most loyal season ticket holders, and then those people are going to displace everybody else in the Coliseum. So really a bad idea. You don't ever take away 9,000 seats, sideline seats, when you've only got about 38,000 from end zone to end zone, but that's what they chose to do. I just think it was more of not really knowing what they were doing. As to the cost, as to the, you know, what the Olympic bid mattered, I don't know, because, first of all, you know, it's probably going to be 2028. That's a long time away. And whether, you know, they're not going to be the sole like they were in the previous two Olympics, because you're going to have that Rams stadium. And I guess they're going to get, you know, they're going to have to split the opening and closing ceremonies. I mean, I think it's almost embarrassing when you look at it now. It looks like, you know, something that a Roman emperor would, you know, construct for himself. You know, the heck with the rest of the people in the Coliseum. I want to have a, you know, a big place to, you know, a reviewing stand or whatever. And that's kind of what it looks like. And that's not, they're not good for anybody, but I think it was a matter of they just got out over their skis. They promised stuff that they thought would help them raise the money easily, which it did, and then I don't think they totally understood the consequences of doing it this way, and now they're stuck, and I think at this point there's just no one who wants to say, maybe we ought to rethink this, or maybe, you know, the last thing you ever hear at a big, you know, bureaucratic, you know, higher educational institution is, man, I screwed up. We shouldn't have done that. Or let's do it right now. And we'll admit, you know, we weren't really thinking this thing through. That ain't going to happen. Okay. You know, they've even been given an extra year because of the Rams having to stay another year. And, they could have used that, I would have thought, to take a pause. But at this point, it's so hard. I don't think one of the problems in dealing with this at USC, it's very hard to pin down who exactly made this decision. How did it get made? And people are afraid to kind of say what they really think about it because they don't know whose ox they're going to gore if they come out and say what they really think. So it's not an example of the best decision-making process that you've ever seen, which is a shame because the more you look at USC's campus, they get everything right and they figure out how to make it all work together. And you look at University Village and you think, good Lord, this is as good as it gets. And, you know, there are people that say the whole, because the USC is the anchor at one end, that the Figueroa Corridor is like the best urban development, private urban development in the last 25 years in America. That there's no place that's come farther, faster, and better than the Figueroa Corridor from downtown to USC. And the reason it is that way is USC. USC is the prime mover, and you hate to see them get something as prominent and as public and as important as the Coliseum wrong. But the whole combination of the historical, you know, people in the LA Conservancy and all of that, it all went together in a way that just didn't really work. And what they needed to be able to do at this point is to step back and say, let's rethink this. Let's bring in one or two of the top stadium architecture firms. I mean, that's already where you're in trouble. If you're doing something that important at a place as important as USC and the Coliseum, and you don't engage one of the top stadium, you know, there are three or four that are the elite stadium architecture firms in the U.S. and the world. And if you don't engage one of them, at the very least, you could bring one or two of them in to take a look at it and say, what do you think of this? And that hasn't been done either. And that's, I think, a big mistake. And they could afford to take a timeout and say, well, maybe we won't do it this year. We'll put it off for another year. And that would be, you know, that's all you can hope for at this point, that they'll get it exactly right. You can't hope for that. But the hope for it would be to put it off, rethink it, and come back with a better plan. But
doesn't seem like that's happening.
But most of the good plans are canceled out just because if you take a look at all the great stadiums in America and the way they've been redesigned and the way they've been expanded and all the things and that, none of them really promised their founders, donors, and what have you, the closest possible access to the field. That makes it really hard. And nobody else has done that. And nobody else has needed that. I mean, most people, you know, but they took the one model from Texas A&M that makes it so hard to do anything else. And they just didn't realize that building that big old monstrosity of a building in the middle of the sands people were going to react like this. I mean, I don't think anybody even asked themselves, how do they think those 9,000 people are going to feel who are getting booted out of their seats that they've had for 40 years? I dare say that question was never asked in a meeting. And they're going to now have to answer that question this year or next year.
Yeah.
And that's not going to go well.
Well, we went 1 week without talking about the Coliseum, but we can't expect to.
I know. It was like for a while, I didn't want to talk about the NCAA stuff because it made you sad. You just said, this shouldn't have happened. So you tried to avoid it. I mean, you can't avoid it now because of Todd McNair, but the trial coming up and all that. But the Coliseum gets to some of the same way where you just say, this makes me sad. This shouldn't have happened.
Yeah. Should not. All right. Well, that's Dan Weber. Great job on the site. We got a lot of stuff coming up on uscfootball.com, so make sure you keep checking it out. Listen to the podcast, of course, but you want to check out what's going on the site. We got stuff going on every hour of every day, it seems like, something new is going up. So make sure you check out Dan. And, Dan, thanks again for coming on. We went an hour and 20 minutes today.
So okay. Well, a little longer. Fun. Good questions. Good questions. Some new guys on here. That's great. Glad to hear from you.
Yeah. We love hearing from all you. Thanks so much for sending those in. Thanks again to Dan Weber. And I'm actually taking off to see my sister on Wednesday, so I'll be back over the weekend. So no more podcasts this week, most likely. But if you want to send your questions again next week, we'll be back and back doing regular shows. And we'll be back with a new website next week. So cross your fingers. Should be cool. So uscfootball.com will be on a whole new platform by Monday. So hope you guys enjoyed this edition of the Peristyle Podcast, and we will talk to you next time.
You may have noticed that shopping at Trader Joe's is unlike shopping at other markets. People ask us all the time how we manage to have such unique, interesting, and delicious products at such great everyday prices. This is Dan Bain of Trader Joe's. The answer is simple. It's all in the way we do business. We buy directly from the manufacturer whenever possible. This helps to keep our costs low, and we pass those savings on to you. No gimmicks, just great values at honest prices every day at Trader Joe's. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by uscfootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. And don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your smartphone or tablet for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.